ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When was the last time you really looked at your kettle, your umbrella, the hallway mirror, or even a gravestone? Every one of them was designed by someone for a reason. And those choices are still shaping how you live. The ordinary isn't ordinary at all. That's By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Find it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you think of a big tree in your neighbourhood, when I was a child, I reckon I would have had a good crack at scaling that tree, climbing as high as I could go. And up in the canopy was a place for my imagination to roam. But what if the top of that tree was also a portal to a whole other world? Now, I'm not talking about Ina Blyton's Folk of the Faraway Tree here, although I did love the lands at the top of that one too. I'm thinking about the dark sky above, the night sky, and the lessons it has to offer us in science and in its stories about our shared origins. Could it be a unifier in times of conflict?
And this is all in front of Australia. This knowledge is going to become one of the great excitements. And it's not something to fear or to sneer. It's both beautiful and romantic, and it's calculus and it's science.
Natasha Mitchell joining you from the Melbourne Planetarium at ScienceWorks in Naarm, Melbourne on Bunurong Country today at a Melbourne Writers Festival event with award-winning author of Dark Emu, poet and Aboriginal farmer Bruce Pascoe, and astrophysicist and honorary fellow at CSIRO, Professor Ray Norris. Together they've co-authored a new book about Aboriginal astronomy and its relationship with Western science. It's called Big Sky, When the Emu Left the Earth. Yes, welcome to Big Ideas. Our email, bigideas@abc.net.au, the ABC Radio National text line, 0418 226 576. Go and talk to us while you're listening. You know, I love this book because it's a dialogue between both of you. It is a dialogue with history. It is a dialogue with story, with culture, and with the sky above. I'm curious at the outset to get a sense from each of you about what the sky above, what the night sky is to you, your relationship with the night sky. Bruce?
I'm just entranced. I think humans for millennia have found the night sky entrancing, and I love being awake at night. I don't fear sleeplessness because I've got the sky. I live in the country. I can see us rotating and the different perspectives you get. But also there's birds and bats at night. So it's just something I look forward to.
I get the sense that you even wake up multiple times in the night to check in on the sky.
I love it. I always say I know what time it is because I know what I'm looking at out the window, and that beautiful sense of stellar motion, it makes you human because you know how significant you are in relationship to it, but it's still given to you.
How significant you are, but I wonder also how insignificant you are.
That's the thing, isn't it? I might have said significance, but I meant insignificance. You just know that you're a fragment. You have no ego after midnight.
Love that. Ray Norris, what about you? As an astronomer originally trained in Britain, this night sky bug captured you early on, didn't it?
Well, it's always raining in Britain, so you don't see much of it. But as a professional scientist, my entire career has been spent studying the sky. So to me, you know, I go to work in the morning and I'm out there 13 billion light years away, you know, studying what's going on out there is my life. But there's another aspect. Using our telescopes up at Narrabri, northern New South Wales, and sitting in front of a computer terminals, observing the telescopes, and the telescope's doing fine. So you just wander outside for a bit, maybe 2 a.m. or something like that, and you've got this inky blackness above you. And you cannot help, you know, it's a warm, lovely warm evening. You lie down in the grass and you stare up there and you see the telescopes around you doing your experiments. But with your eyes, you get a completely different sort of relationship. Wondering things like, are there other civilizations up there looking back at me? There are maybe billions of other civilizations. You know, we think we're so important here on Earth, on our grotty little planet. No, it's a beautiful planet, sorry. It's our beautiful little planet in sort of western suburbs of the galaxy. Somebody in the center of the galaxy wouldn't even know we're here. And somebody in another galaxy somewhere wouldn't even know our galaxy was there. And we are totally insignificant in the grand scheme of things. We might blow ourselves up or whatever. The universe will just keep rolling along and doing its thing and expanding, and dark energy does its thing. And just, we are just so totally insignificant. Having said which, I also think it's amazing that we on Earth can, without leaving the surface of our planet, we look up in the sky and we try to figure out how the universe works. And we're fairly successful.
We are fairly successful. Bruce Pascoe, it's this connection between country and sky that is a very strong part of this book. I'll never look at trees in the same way again, and we'll come to that. But tell us this connection, this mirroring between earth and sky that is very consistent in First Nations cultures across Australia.
Yeah, everywhere you go, people will tell you that whatever is on earth is mirrored in the sky. That connection between those, the two, is via the tallest thing that people could see, which would be a giant tree. And not only are those trees important culturally, they exist, people will be able to take you to a particular tree and say, that's the tree that's in the story. All these years later, and I was shown a tree in the Tanami, and they said, that's the tree that allowed us to tell our story through the owl, a particular owl. And the tree was only that high and was obviously a young tree. And they saw me look at it and they said, yeah, but its mother is there too. It just keeps on coming up. This tree keeps rejuvenating itself.
So there's this idea of the tree as a sky bridge between Earth and ancestors above.
People have access to the heavens through that tree. They climb that tree and get closer to the heavens. And I've seen it in Queensland, Tasmania, New South Wales, WA. We should never cut down a big tree in this country again. We should do everything in our power to leave those big trees, because they are people and they are telling a story, and they are our connection to the sky. That's our bridge. And we need those trees, not just, so we can hug them. We need those trees because they are culturally significant.
So just give us a sense then of this mirroring between earth and sky, between the law of country and the law of sky. What's the relationship between the two?
It's a mesh. There are sky stories, there are land stories, there are ocean stories, there are stories about people ascending into the sky, of creatures like the emu ascending into the sky, but there are also stories of the whale. Now, the whale's up in the sky as well, but all of these things are linked. You can't separate that emu from that whale, from that possum, from that ant. The whole thing has to be understood in totality. It's not one Bible story here, one Bible story there. That's an invitation to Australia. Know and love your country. She's a beautiful thing. And your neighbouring continents are beautiful things. So know and love them. And you can understand them by looking at the sky, or you can understand them lying down on your back like Ray does in the grass and smelling the grass and seeing the sky at the same time. You know, this is not a book about the stars. This is a book about the totality of human experience in space.
You make the point that often Western astronomers saw figures of war above us, but Aboriginal people see figures of creation and also of moral guidance. How so? Describe that for us.
Well, it's not like having the Seventh-day Adventists up there providing moral guidance. Aboriginal society was terribly moral and terribly strict. So the stories that I look at down in Yuin country on the Wallagra River are all about sharing food. We see that on the earth, we see it in the sky. They're really basic instructions for people. From my bedroom window, I look at a mountain which is a big damper, Dangar. That Dangar was made by two brothers, and they wanted, it was such a magnificent bread. It sounds like COVID when everyone was making sourdough, but they wanted to keep that bread to themselves. It was so magnificent. And Dharma, the creator, watched them plotting to hide this food from their brothers and sisters and pulled down the tree in which they'd hid the damper to hide it from their people and struck the two brothers and killed them. I can look at that mountain from my house. It's such a simple story. You share food. You share food. That's all it is.
And the sky is full of those stories as well, stories of and instructions. Well,
and it's the tree. It comes back to the tree. The tree, it was there used illegally to hide food from people. And Dharma brought that tree down.
Author of Dark Emu, Bruce Pascoe, and astrophysicist Professor Ray Norris are joining you with me, Natasha Mitchell, opening your eyes and minds to Aboriginal astronomy as they do in their new book, Big Sky, When the Emu Left the Earth. This is Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen from the Melbourne Writers' Festival and the Melbourne Planetarium. Ray Norris, this fascination for you of the connection between country and sky started when you were a young astronomer as well. And in Britain, you had stone circles that told a story of what was going on above. Tell us about that interest for you.
Yeah, so as Bruce said, all around the world, we find Indigenous people are fascinated by the sky. Not just fascinated by it, but they're trying to understand it. They're trying to see its relevance to their lives. I think this idea of mirroring, one of the lovely things about Indigenous culture in Australia is, of course, it's a very much a living culture and we can learn a lot from it. Whereas in Britain, of course, there's a dead culture. We have no idea what the Bronze Age people thought. But what we do see are these stone circles. They're built like Stonehenge, which clearly we don't understand their motives, but they were using these to study the sky, to try to understand the sky and relate it to their lives and to their deaths. So that was the thing that first turned me on to this idea of the links between human culture and experience and what's going on up there in the sky. So when we moved to Australia many years ago, despite my accent, I'm much more Australian than English, I was fascinated by the way that Aboriginal people had this tremendous connection to the sky, and here is a living culture which is experiencing this right now.
Okay, you say you were fascinated, but you were also very sceptical of this idea that Aboriginal people were the first astronomers.
Yeah.
So take us on this journey that you've okay. been on over the last number of decades. One, it was a kind of a journey of inquiry for you as to what Aboriginal astronomy is, how it compares to the astronomy that you were trained in, but it's cleaved open a whole set of powerful dialogues for you. So take us there. Why were you sceptical?
As a scientist, I'm naturally sceptical of everything. I want to see some hard evidence or something, some really good evidence before I take something seriously. And this is the way that science works. Bruce and I, by the way, argue about dates when people arrive in Australia. Mm. And I think we end up sort of agreeing, actually. But the way that science works, science is basically conservative. I think we all agreed that people came to Australia at least 65,000 years ago. Is it 120,000? Maybe. Bruce would argue that it is. I'll say, well, the evidence is a bit dodgy, so naturally I'm sceptical. So when people tell me, oh yes, the Aboriginal people understood all this stuff about the sky, my reaction is...
And that they were astronomers.
Yeah.
And are astronomers.
Yeah, so I think initially, I'm really embarrassed to say it, I say it in the beginning of the book, that I was incredibly naive when I came into this. And I was thinking, come on, you know, it can't be too hard. Were Aboriginal people really trying to understand the sky? Were they really astronomers? Did they understand how the planets moved and things like that? Or were they just singing songs about the night sky because it looked pretty?
So did you think that the stories that were being told were fairy stories, folk stories, but not science?
Yeah, that's right. So the songs and stories are clearly beautiful. I could appreciate them as works of art and works of culture. But were the Aboriginal people actually trying to understand the sky? And when I started getting into this field, I thought, well, that can't be too hard. I can knock this over in a matter of a few months, surely. You know, is there evidence for this or not?
And what happened?
Instead, you find yourself embarking on this enormously long journey. Firstly, I totally misunderstood the way that Aboriginal culture works. You can't ask those simple questions. There's many deep levels of understanding. Oh, spoiler alert, yes, there was science there, by the way. It turned out lots of science, and even enough to convince a sceptical scientist. But along the way, I found that the questions I was asking were actually the wrong questions, that I'd completely misunderstood how Aboriginal culture works. And now, you know, I've been studying this for a few decades, but I'm still painfully aware of my woeful ignorance. And I keep on finding new things that mean, oh, wow, yeah, I'm not really asking the right question there.
So how did you then connected with a whole range of Aboriginal communities and Aboriginal elders mentored you and have continued to mentor you in this journey of understanding? What did you start to understand differently?
So the critical point for me, I think, is a particular meeting. A friend of mine, the late Hugh Cairns, who'd been studying this, he had written a book with senior Waterman elder Bill Yidamda Mahani, and there's book launch in Darwin. I thought, I'll go up and go to the book launch and meet some of these people. And I had a conversation with Uncle Yidamda. I was just totally gobsmacked by how much he knew about the sky was the first thing. Now, I'm a professional astrophysicist, but there's probably amateur astronomers in the audience who can name many, many stars than I can. All my astronomy is basically done through a computer. He can look up at the sky, he can name pretty well every star up there, and he has a story about it. And then if I start asking about the motions of the planets, people sometimes say, do Aboriginal people know the difference between the planets and the stars? Well, duh. And there are Aboriginal people who spend their entire lives studying the sky as elders, like Bill. He really is an Aboriginal astronomer. And they study the sky every night and they watch how the planets move through the stars. And of course they can see the difference. Bill, and many other Aboriginal people also know about the finer points of planetary motion, how they don't just go along like that, but they sometimes stop, loop back and then go forward. And there's technical astronomical terms that we use, the path the planets take, we call it the ecliptic. Bill has a name for it. He recognises that path. He calls it Yondoran. He can navigate fantastically with using the sky. It's just the depth of his knowledge. So that's the thing that first really blew my mind.
And you continue talking ever since.
Yes, that's right.
But what you discovered was that the sky above it's a map, it's a calendar, it's a clock. It is all of those things.
And much more besides. So, as Bruce was saying, that Aboriginal people learn a lot of their lore from the sky. I mean, if I can tell a specific example, there's a lovely song line. It's one of my favourite song lines. Sorry, dreaming tracks. But Bruce prefers to call them dreaming tracks. When, for the Yolngu people in Arnhem Land, when the planet Venus, Barnabir, she flies across the sky. She brought the first humans to Australia in this great, long, complex story. But as she flies across the land, she provides a route for people to travel if they're navigating. That's great. She also sings this song, which as she's flying along, she looks down, she sees the mountains, she sees the waterholes. She lays out what land belongs to which clans. She lays all the basis of Yolngu law. She explains how people may intermarry and how they may not intermarry. And all this knowledge is laid out in this song that she sings as she's flying across the land, which people now
This is sing. The movement of Venus.
Yes. Yes, and this is all Venus doing this. Lots of ceremonies associated with it. So the sky is doing so much more than just being a clock and a calendar and a navigational aid. It's also laying down, telling you how you should live, actually.
Bruce Pascoe, Ray Norris's personal journey towards an understanding is not unfamiliar to you. And, you make the really powerful point in this book that, in fact, it's often been, and no offence to any astronomers in the room, but it's often been actually Australian astronomers that have resisted a conversation about Aboriginal astronomy, and international astronomers have come here with a sort of a brighter, more open sense of curiosity to investigate the connections between what they do and what Aboriginal people have done as they look to the sky for 60,000 years.
It's very common in Australia for the people who come from overseas who seem to feel a liberty in talking about these things when Australian academics feel an inhibition. And that's, I think, goes to the heart of a kind of reverse cultural cringe in Australian academics. But that's changing. Now, Ray and I have a mutual friend called John Morrison. We're skating on thin ice now because John Morrison's work, and one of the great features of his work, we can't talk about, because when it was exposed through his research, it got vandalised. And so the people who belong to that country no longer want it spoken about. So a piece of this great science, this great humanity, has been withdrawn from the public gaze. But that science that John Morrison did revealed all of the things that Ray's just been talking about, all the observation but also the calculation of where stellar objects were going to be at a certain time. That's really sophisticated maths. We can talk about Mithaca country, where there are also giant sculptures that travel over hundreds of acres, which are about the night sky, and telling a story. And that story that Ray told about Venus, the great beauty of it is that you can show your children that. You can say, now see that? That was who gave the Yolngu their land. The education is in the sky for them. And this is all in front of Australia. This knowledge is going to become one of the great excitements. And it's not something to fear or to sneer. This is knowledge, and it's both beautiful and romantic, and it's calculus and it's science. At the moment, science is being sneered at as if it's some kind of fake beast. But we, the people of the world, have to say, no, we love this. We love that story. We love the story of Venus delegating lands to people, but we also love the mathematics of it.
And the thing was, the stories are a powerful data set of data in a culture that was orally transmitted rather than written down. So this is a data set, isn't it? These stories are a data set. And you make the interesting, dreadful observation that actually engravings in, you know, sacred engravings that are being destroyed by mining companies, that's a data set, because there are sky stories in some of those engravings that we are losing because they're being destroyed.
It doesn't even happen in Brazil, that destruction of that ancient art, but it happens in our country. And it's Junkan Gorge. It's a really horrible expression of Australianism. And I don't really think that reflects the population of Australia. It's something which is imposed on us by the people who are empowered to destroy. I think Australia will take a much stronger and much more loving stance on their country and on Aboriginal culture, because they will come to learn how important this is, not just for Australian Aboriginal people, but for the world, for humans, because it is telling a story which has been built over 65,000 years. Or Bill Bowler did research at Warrnambool. See, I'm getting into really controversial territory now. Bill examined a hearth, a human hearth at Warrnambool, and it measured 120,000 years old. Some people are saying that is controversial reflection of the result, but the alternative is a pyromaniac seagull, and I don't think seagulls have it in them.
Big timescales under a big sky. Natasha Mitchell with you from under the dome of the glorious Melbourne Planetarium at Science Works, with author of Dark Emu, Bruce Pascoe, and astrophysicist Ray Norris on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. We're talking about their new book on Aboriginal astronomy. The book is called Big Sky, When the Emu Left the Earth. How did the emu leave the Earth? And why did the emu leave the Earth?
Well, she'd done her work. There are all sorts of different stories there. You know, some people have a different story, but one of the stories I've heard is that she had done her work and she ran up a stone ramp, and the petroglyphs in the Sydney Basin will show you how she ran up this ramp and then disappeared into the sky. Other people have a different story, but they're all correct. It depends where you are on the Earth to tell you which story you tell.
Mm.
They're all right. We see it time and time again. The Sydney Basin sandstone petroglyphs show positions of the moon and men and women in relation to that. And at one point, the figure is a man and then transitions to a woman. Now, I don't want Barnaby Joyce to get involved in this, but this transition is a natural thing, and it is telling us something. On the south coast in Yuin country, we talk about grandfather sun, grandmother moon. You go a little bit further north from Sydney and it's reversed.
Mm.
I think, and I don't know, I think there's something going on with that depiction, and this is all in front of Australia.
Yeah, I love the variation of the stories, and you encourage us to sit in comfort with that variation, because it's a live conversation, live cultural conversation. Ray Norris, the sun and the moon, the variation of stories is fascinating. Take us there, because as Bruce explained, the moon is often a man moon. The moon is often not a very nice character. The sun is often a female character, but then they might gender switch. The variation is amazing.
Yeah.
But are there consistencies?
Like Bruce, I wouldn't say they're inconsistencies. There's different versions. I mean, you look at the Bible, the four Gospels, they've got different stories, but you don't say, oh, yeah, therefore that Gospel's wrong. I think on the whole, of all the stories I've heard, the majority say the sun is this lovely old lady who moves across the sky every day, giving us heat and warmth. And the moon is this really bad man. I'll tell you the Yongnuu story. He's this bad man called Nyalindi. He was very lazy. He got very fat from eating stuff, not doing any work. Very round. He's the full moon, right? His wives and his sons got really cross with him for doing this. So as you would, they started chopping bits off him. And that's how you get the phases of the moon.
What we all do, isn't
it? Quite reasonable, yeah. And then eventually he dies and becomes the new moon. And he stayed dead for 3 days, 3 nights. And then he came back to life again. And then he got big and fat and round. There's various versions of that. But it's a very common sort of story across Australia. But one of the main things is that in this process, he cursed the earth. He said, look, from now on, when you guys die, you're dead. When I die, I'm going to come back to life again. And so he brought death to the world. And you get various versions of this story. The version I've just told you is a Yolngu children's story. And there's deeper versions, which I can't talk about, where he does much worse things, various taboo things. And so there's lots of different levels of meaning. When boys get initiated, they hear about the different deeper levels of these stories from the moon. And they're, again, they're stories telling them how to live their lives.
One of the great stories in this book is also that of Orion. And people would look to Orion and go, oh, well, that's a Greek warrior, of course. And you do not see Orion in that way anymore, do you?
No. Well, the thing is, if you're in Britain and you look up Orion and you're told, oh, yeah, that's a Greek warrior, that's his belt, that's his sword, those are his arms, you still need an awful lot of imagination. It really doesn't look like a Greek warrior. In Australia, Orion is the other way up. So you've got to imagine him as an upside-down Greek warrior, which is even harder, which is why Australians call him the saucepan.
Yeah.
It's a great, great name. But, yeah, there's a young story that actually Orion is this canoe full of boys. Now, the three stars in the line, they're the belt, and they're the three boys sitting in a canoe, and there's Betelgeuse at the front and Rigel at the rear, and they're the top and ends of the canoe. So if you can imagine that, you go out and look at Orion and see it as this canoe, you'll never be able to unsee that. There's like a lot of these things. Once you've seen it, it's such an obvious interpretation. Why would people go into Greek hunters and things? Anyway, but the story goes that these boys were out fishing and they couldn't catch anything. And in the end, they caught a kingfish, but they're from the kingfish clan, so it's taboo to eat kingfish. And one of the boys caught a kingfish, and the sun saw that, and she was really angry with them, so she blew them up into the sky as a warning to all the other kids that you've got to obey these laws of your clan, your skin. But there's another interesting aspect to this. As you say, in Greek mythology, Orion is a hunter. In most places around the world, Orion is a male constellation. And then they have stories about how Orion chases the Pleiades, the seven sisters, just like as in the Greek stories. And across Australia, you've got these stories of how this man in Orion or the men in Orion are chasing these girls, the seven sisters, with evil intentions towards the youngest of them in particular, quite often. The story, again, changes a bit across Australia. It's a very common story. And you ask, how come the Australian story is so similar to the Greek story, and by the way, to other stories around the world? Okay, the traditional explanation is, well, obviously the Brits brought it with them in 1788. They taught the Aboriginal people this lovely story. Aboriginal people incorporated into their culture. Well, that really doesn't work because you see this story across the country. It can't spread that quickly. You see these ancient cave paintings of the story. It goes back thousands of years. So the Aboriginal people had this story before the Brits came. And there's been almost no cultural contact between Australia and the rest of the world. So the Aboriginal people have had this story for an awful long time. And my guess, and it's a very controversial guess, I should say, is that actually the Aboriginal people brought this story with them when they came out of Africa 65,000 years or 120,000 years, whatever it was, with them.
Has anyone investigated it, and how would you?
What do you think I'm spending half my time doing at the moment?
Because what you're doing is you're linking then Aboriginal people back to the story of humanity as it they came out of Africa through a sky story, through the story of the Seven Sisters.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's actually interesting. There's I wrote an article about this stuff, and I was contacted by a French researcher, Julien Dwy, who, from a completely different perspective, he'd been analysing sky stories using a genetic approach, and he'd come to complete the same conclusion completely independently, which is really nice. So we've got now got two bits of evidence.
How do you analyse sky stories through genetics?
Oh, well, it's the way, how you trace the different genes in a string of DNA and see how DNA evolves from one form to the other. You can do the same with stories. You look at, take the Seven Sisters stories, you'd say, were there seven girls or six? Was the man in Orion or was it several men in Orion? You take these different elements, and they're like little genes, and you trace how these change with time. And what Dwy did was he traced how these stories change around the world and tried to see the path of how the story evolved, just like you'd see how DNA evolved over time.
Wow.
And using this way, he found that this story was indeed really old. It goes right back to Africa in 100,000 BC or whatever, and it looks like it, there's this path from Africa to Australia with this story.
When you hear that, Bruce, what do you think?
Well, I think it's just, it talks about humans, because the Japanese tell a very similar story about a wicked man chasing the girls. It just shows that this animal that we are looks up at the night sky and imagines, not just imagines what life might be like, but also wonders about who they are. Mm. You know, how come humans are here? How come they're a kingfish? How come they're a kingfishers? Humans are wondering this every day of their life, and they look to the night sky because it's so full of story. This common humanity is something to be celebrated, not feared, and not reduced into bedtime stories.
So in a sense, the night sky is our great unifier.
I think this is how the world comes together in the end, finding these common stories. I am certain that when all the world tells their whale story, they'll find that it's very similar. All around Australia, whale stories, they're not identical. They have different elements, but they are so similar. This story was pervasive in Australia, not as an accident, because there was communication on the story tracks right around the country, so that people were aware of how each other were thinking. And I think when we investigate the Seven Sisters, when we investigate the whale, we'll find how similar we are to each other, that the American is no better than the Irinese, that we have goodness within us, and we have this desire to be better people. I don't think we will find that we have a desire to destroy each other. I think that is the big myth. And in Australia, it was demonstrated for however many years it was that a government in Australia decided that we would act together, that we would have no army, that we would have no police, and we would have no prison, that we would cooperate with each other. It didn't mean that humans stopped behaving badly. They still did. And so they had to be constrained. And that is what government is, constraint. And we should welcome the constraint, because that is how we get along.
We've talked about the moon, we've talked about the sun, we've talked about the emu, the Seven Sisters. How did First Nations people, Ray, Norris, how have they viewed comets, meteors, those objects that move with a great flash in the sky or a twinkle, or what are the stories that have emerged there?
So I think everywhere in the world, pretty well, people see the sky, the stars and the planets, something unchanging, predictable, something that's governing the way your life keeps ticking along. And suddenly this meteor shoots across the sky,
zoom,
disrupting stuff. Yeah, or a comet appears. Comets appear slowly over a period of months, perhaps. And you think, what the hell is going on there? And so you go back, you see the Chinese astronomers predicting all sorts of terrible things going to happen. And same through in most indigenous cultures, they see them as bad things. The comets are often accused of bringing diseases and things like that. Meteors are often associated with death. So if somebody dies, his spirit might go up to the sky, and then you see them flashing across the sky as a meteor. In Waterman culture with Billy Yamdarama, he's got this lovely story where he says, when you die, your spirit goes up to the sky, goes actually through a portal, which is the star Vega, goes up there and goes through a period of purification. And that he's got this great, long, beautiful story, which I can't possibly tell, but it's so beautiful when he tells it, about all the ceremonies that go on to your spirit up in the sky. And everything happens around this ground oven, which Bill says is the center of ceremonies, which happens to be where the black hole is in our Milky Way, which Bill and I spend a lot of time talking about. How come your ground oven is where my black hole is? And I don't know. Anyway, eventually your spirit comes back from the sky, falls down to the earth as a shooting star, as a meteor, and falls into the ground. And then your spirit lies there and waits for your next mother to come along. And you'll sit there, in fact, in a creek, being looked after by rock cod. It gets very quite specific. And you wait for your mother to come along, and eventually you'll see her walking along. You jump up into her, and she becomes pregnant, and you're reborn, haven't been purified by the sky. So in that case, the meteors are a good thing. Mm. They're associated with death in one way, but they're also associated with reincarnation.
What about eclipses? There are records of eclipses in written history, but there are also records of eclipses in oral history.
Yeah. So eclipses are something that fascinates everybody, I think. How many people have seen a total solar eclipse? Quite a few.
Oh, yeah, good crowd.
Quite a few. This is not a typical audience. No. As a scientist, if I see a total solar eclipse, I think, wow, that's cool. You get all these funny optical effects and the sky goes dark. Obviously, the day goes dark. Birds go back to their nest, dogs start barking and things. But what I found really interesting, something which I was totally unprepared for, is that you get this, I get this visceral feeling. The world is not right. The sun has gone out in the day. And that actually really shook me. I was not prepared for that. You don't think you have these visceral feelings there. And I think everybody feels that. So it's not surprising. Aboriginal people got lots of stories about eclipses and what they do. Now, there's a couple of things that are surprising. One is that they try to explain what causes an eclipse. Well, with the solar eclipse, there's several groups who say, well, it's caused by the sun woman and the moon man getting together, making love. The body of the moon covers the body of the sun, and so you don't see the sun anymore. Fine, good scientific explanation. These people knew what they were doing. What really surprises me is that when you talk about a lunar eclipse, that's when the Earth gets between the sun and the moon, and the shadow of the Earth goes on the moon. That happens when the sun's up there, the moon's up there, and they also say, hey, that's interesting, yeah, a lunar eclipse happens when the sun woman is chasing the moon man. He wiggles backwards and forwards, tries to escape her, but eventually she catches him, then they make love, and the moon goes out, goes red. Now, what's really surprising about that is that where there's a solar eclipse, you might watch the motion of the sun and the moon and figure out, oh, yeah, it's running in the same place as the sky. Here, you've got the sun behind you, and some Aboriginal Einstein sitting in the bush thousands of years ago was watching this going and somehow connected the fact that it depended on the position of the sun behind them. And that's a real intellectual leap. And I find it amazing that in these old stories, you've got actually evidence of deep intellectual thought thousands of years ago, people trying to figure out what's going on. And that's what I find really interesting about these stories. Another interesting thing, these stories go on from generation to generation. So you might say, yeah, of course, this is an important event. It's quite natural that these stories persist through the generations, except that if I'm in one place on the Earth, I will only see a total solar eclipse maybe once every 10 generations or something. And so somebody talks about the story of what causes an eclipse, pass it on to their grandson or whatever. It gets passed over generation to generation. But these people never actually get to see it. But they know it's sufficiently important. They have to pass it on to the next generation, which implies an enormous, remarkable continuity of thought.
And it's the intellectual aspect of this, Bruce, that very much interests you in your work. How do you see the relationship between Western astronomy and Aboriginal astronomy moving forward together? How do you see the exchange growing between those two approaches?
I think we're waiting for a more generous spirit in Western academic thought to encompass, say, the Chinese, to encompass Aboriginal Australians, to understand and accept what the South American people understood about the universe, to think about these other people as your brothers and sisters, and as Ray so eloquently said, had intellectual thought. So as a world, we should be saying, wasn't that interesting what those South Americans were doing? Wasn't it interesting that that Aboriginal woman understood the relationship between the sun and the moon? And I've had it explained to me very simply up on the escarpment in Arnhem Land, you know, someone pointing out to me the curvature of the earth. You know, how couldn't you understand that the earth was a globe? And if you understand that the earth is a globe, you then understand that she is a globe. And suddenly the motions of these incredible objects becomes understandable. Mm. When we start to respect and give credit for that ancient thought and stop bringing everything back to Greece and Rome and say, no, this happened elsewhere. Mm. The human is a great mind. Let's look at all humanity and let's get the riches from everyone, not just Rome and Greece. We will accept the East as well as the West. And in that way, we'll come together as a people. And many different races, many different languages, many different cultural habits, but we'll be a people, a world people. And we can't avoid it anymore. You know, what's going to happen with climate change, partly to do with the movement of these things in the sky and partly to do with what humans are doing with fossil fuels. Let's not beat around the bush. These things are happening. And with that, there'll be incredible loss of surface area in the world. All of the people living on that surface area will be wanting to come to dry countries. They won't be looking to get social welfare. They'll be looking to stand on dry earth. And we, the owners of dry earth, will have to accept them because they're our brothers and sisters. This is what happened in Australia at various sea level rises. And this is told by the whale. The whale said to the people, stop panicking. If you follow me, I will take you to the dry land. I will show you the dry land. But when you get there, you're going to have to be on your very best behaviour because your cousins who live on the high country, they are related to you, you'll be begging them to share their land and they will share it. That is how good people behave. This is etched in petroglyphs in Tasmania. You can go and anyone can go and see it. And it's a story of such grace, such beauty, and it's told by a whale.
Ray.
How is Aboriginal astronomy seen by mainstream astronomers? When I first got into this maybe 20 years ago, I think people tolerated it. It wasn't anything that's important or relevant, but there's Ray doing weird stuff again, you know. And the mood has definitely changed. I see amongst my fellow members of the astronomical community in Australia a much more interest in this, acceptance and enthusiasm for Aboriginal astronomy.
But let me just say this, just as a final provocation. Often people who engage in this two-way exchange between Aboriginal knowledge and Western scientific knowledge will take great pleasure in using Western science to prove Aboriginal knowledge. And I wonder if that then is still partly a sort of deficit model, that somehow Aboriginal knowledge is only genuine knowledge if Western science comes along and proves it. Bruce or Ray?
I think you just accused me of something, but
No, I haven't at all. No. As a science journal, I've been very interested in this, do you build a real dialogue that is an authentic two-way exchange?
Yeah. I mean, what we'd really like is for Aboriginal knowledge to inform astrophysics. So far, we haven't really seen that happen. I look forward to the day when we find some Aboriginal story which solves some puzzle that how many thousands of years ago did X happen, and suddenly we find this Aboriginal story. So far, that hasn't happened. I look forward to the day when it does. But there's an important way that we can learn, actually. And that's when we've told these stories about the way that Aboriginal science works, about how people have studied the sky, figured out what's going on out there, just by standing in the desert, looking up with our own eyes at a clear sky. This is how science works. When we talk about big science, you know, we think of big radio telescopes and big particle accelerators, which are, you know, great, they do a wonderful job, but they're a bit detached from ordinary people. And my guess is if you want to, in a school, you want to teach a student how science works, you probably don't talk about the particle accelerators and big radio telescopes. You get them thinking about, how does an eclipse work? How do tides work? What do you think meteors are? And get them to retrace that path. And I think these stories of Aboriginal astronomy are a much better way of learning how science works than stories of particle accelerators.
What a wonderful conversation. Thank you for such a terrific book. Really, for me, it feels like there's a certain urgency right now. We need to get these books and this knowledge down on paper so that they can be shared, so it can be shared and the next generations coming through know about this history before elders pass. Please thank Bruce Pascoe and Ray Norris. And after that discussion, we got this gorgeous night sky tour at the Melbourne Planetarium with astronomer Dr. Tanya Hill and elders and members of the Bunurong community and Bunurong Land Council Aboriginal Corporation. Bruce Pascoe and Professor Ray Norris's book is called Big Sky, When the Emu Left the Earth. It's published by Magabala Books. Read it to get that full emu story, by the way. And thanks to the Melbourne Writers Festival, Science Works and the Bunjalaka Aboriginal Cultural Centre for hosting us. Reconciliation in action right there. And this is Reconciliation Week. Look out for events near you. Next on Big Ideas, host of ABC Radio National's By Design and TV's Grand Designs Australia and Restoration Australia, Anthony Burke, with comedian, podcaster, aka Modernista on Instagram, Tim Ross. Both passionate, serious lovers of good architecture. But what's good design got to do with solving the housing crisis?
At the moment, if you're going to use straight up timber out of on a house, like for framing, you're basically committing to using about 30% of a tree. So you cut down the tree to get the timber. To get those sticks of timber, you're using about 30, 35% of the tree to make those pieces of timber. We can't do that. We've got to use the whole tree. If we're going to knock a tree down, we've got to use the whole thing. So every piece of fibre in that tree trunk is being now interrogated for what it can produce and help us to make, if you like. So, you know, cross-laminated timber, all those kinds of engineered timber products that we're seeing out there now, I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to be seeing a whole lot, a much bigger range of that kind of material finding its way, firstly into the obvious stuff, the sticks and the sheets.
Yeah.
But then we're going to start seeing people really kind of go the next step. So because you're kind of reconstituting things, you can actually then start to really enjoy a whole different kind of idea of form making, for example, whole different idea of environmental performance, for example. And that's the kind of the scope of the material change that's going on right now. We're at the tip of that, well, the very beginning of that process, I think.
That's next on Big Ideas. Find Big Ideas episodes on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review too. Our email, bigideas@abc.net.au. Love hearing from you. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.